This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
China's foreign interference isn't new in Canada, especially not if you've been paying attention. Hello, and welcome to the Full Comment Podcast. My name's Brian Lilly, your host, and today we're going to delve back into an issue that we've touched on many times. Wasn't that long ago that we were speaking with Michelle Junot-Katsuya about Project Sidewinder and how, as early as the 1990s, Canadian politicians had been warned that foreign interference by China was happening. Since then, they've tended to ignore it over and over and over again. Now we've got a public inquiry that's on the go, and my worry is that they are ignoring that. Jonathan Manthorpe is someone who has been paying attention to this issue for quite a while. He is the author of a book named Claws of the Panda, Beijing's Campaign of Influence and Intimidation in Canada. It came out in 2019. I picked it up a couple of years ago, but he's about to release an updated version with everything that's happened over the last 5 years, which is a lot. Jonathan, thanks for the time. Welcome to the Full Comment Podcast.
Oh, delighted to be here, Brian.
Before we get into your book and the update that's coming out, everything since the arrest of Meng Wanzhou, let's talk about the inquiry. I don't think that the government wants people to pay attention to it. I think they want to downplay it. And I also think that an awful lot of Canadians aren't paying attention to it. But my bet is that you are. What are your thoughts so far?
Yeah, I'm very disappointed in the inquiry for a number of reasons. The main one is that I think that it is drawn far too narrowly, which sort of sustains your point about the government not being keen on it. Its mandate at the moment is only to look at election interference. Now, election interference is actually a relatively small part of the Chinese Communist Party's interference in Canada. And it may not even, in my view, it's perhaps not even the most important one. That's a downside to begin with. But the thing that really gets my goat, I have to say, and I've been following this story, in fact, since about 1971. What really gets my goat is that the parliamentarians really only got interested in this and started to do anything about it and having not only this public inquiry, but committee inquiries, when they were in the frame, when the whole issue of election interference came up. Now, where you really need to look at the interference by the Chinese Communist Party is in things like our universities, is in business, is in their intimidation of Canadians of Chinese, Tibetan, and Uyghur heritage here. Now, those people have had a platform in this inquiry, thankfully, but they've been sending heartfelt messages and reports to government about what's happening in their communities for years and years and years. And it's only when their own ox is being gored that the parliamentarians have woken up.
But I would say if Canadians can't get upset at China trying to pick our government for us, they're probably not going to get upset at the rest. And you've written about this in the past. Others have written about it in the past. And as you say, no one paid attention until it was in the electoral realm. And now it's in the electoral realm. And you could see them trying to downplay it by saying, oh, okay, well, in addition to China's interference, what about Russia? What did Russia do? And what about India? And from following the issues, I knew from the beginning that Russia was not interfering in our elections because they don't care. All they want to do is undermine faith in democracy and the Western way of life. India has very specific aims for their interference. They want to make every Gurdwara look like a terrorist cell. They want to paint every Sikh as an extremist. And that's what the Modi government's been doing. I'm told there's been a little bit of attempts at electoral interference, but that's primarily it. what it was. And the inquiry has at least borne that out. But it's still, as you say, too narrowly drawn. What did you make of the Prime Minister getting up to testify? I guess it's about 2 weeks ago now. And he seemed to have, in my view, what I wrote in my columns was that he had two main objectives. One, say that he didn't know about certain information because he didn't read it. Later said, oh no, I read everything. And two, to undermine CSIS. And those seem to be his goals, not actually speaking the truth. Yeah.
No, I'm inclined to agree with you. It was a very carefully crafted performance, and I basically agree with your judgment on it. The relationship with CSIS is a very interesting one, and you've had a program on Sidewinder, and that's a very good example. And I dealt with this at some length in the first edition of the book. It was a very good example of attempts by politicians to minimize what's said to them by intelligence agencies. That report was just junked. But you know, looking at it then and looking at it now, it was absolutely accurate. Now, it had a few sort of technical flaws, nothing very much. But you know, as you say, that was back in the 1990s. And also in the 1990s, there was one of the first public papers by a CSIS analyst, Holly Porteous, her name was. She wrote a paper looking at the way the Chinese Communist Party's main political warfare organization, the United Front Work Department, had been used in the run-up to the handover of Hong Kong. And then she went on from that to set out how the United Front would be used in Canada. And she anticipated that after the handover of Hong Kong, China would turn its attention even more fully on Canada than it had been until then. And it was already, the level of infiltration at that point was very high in Canada, in business, in academia, in politics. And that was a public paper back late 1990s. So, you know, the CSIS has been banging this drum since it was founded in the mid 1980s. So there is nothing new here. The problem is, as you point out, political will. And what we do not have in this country yet, unlike Australia, unlike the United States, which have also been infiltrated very heavily by the Chinese Communist Party, what we don't have is political will to do anything about it. We have all the tools that we need, but we don't have political will.
So when I speak to Canadians who don't follow politics closely, often you'll get people who just roll their eyes and say, well, why would China be interested in us? We're too small. You say you've been watching this since 1971. That's the year I was born. And I'm not a spring chicken. So why would China be interested? Because people simply don't believe it.
Well, I tell you, well, the answer is very easy. It began in China in the 1940s when the Chinese Communist Party first became aware in any serious way of Canadian missionaries, Canadian diplomats. And they realized that these guys represented an open window into North America. If you couldn't play with the Americans, which was very difficult for the Chinese Communist Party at that time, the Americans were very, very suspicious. But Canada was the window into North America, and the premier or the head of the time, Chou Enlai, a very charming man, a very subtle man. He realized also that Canada's sort of ambiguous relationship and attitude towards the Americans could be used. You know, we are both envious and also feel rather superior Americans at the same time. And he realized that this presented a huge opportunity. And so he put a lot of emphasis on establishing relations with Canadians he found in China. And then in the early 1960s, he dispatched a really very important figure, Paul Lin. He was a committed Chinese nationalist, and in 1949, when the communists took over in China, he took his family to China, became a very significant player. And in 1962, Zhou Enlai dispatched him back to Canada to set up the network of agents of influence Lin was an academic. He set up a East Asian center at McGill University, and at the same time he fostered links to the the Canadian business world through and helped set up the Canada-China Business Council, which remains absolutely fundamental body for Chinese influence in Canada. He set up links through academia and exchange of students, which allowed Chinese scientists to come on Canadian universities and pinch Canadian technology, which is still, in my view, one of the most important aspects that is not being looked at really very closely enough.
It's interesting that you said McGill University in Montreal, because it was about 25 years ago, I was working as a reporter in Montreal, and I just noticed that there was an obsession among the political class with China. And so many of them would retire from politics and get a job somehow related to China or visit China. And I thought, this is odd. I don't see this in Ontario. I hadn't worked across the country at that point, but I could definitely say I had not seen that in Ontario. And the Montreal business and political class were absolutely fascinated, mesmerized by China.
Well, the link on that is the Power Corporation and the Desmarais. They were instrumental in the formation of the Canada-China Business Council. Paul Desmarais was the first president of the Canada-China Business Council. His son, André Desmarais, followed him. And the Power Corporation remains the hub of the Canada China Business Council. Now, through that link, we have had four prime ministers who have worked for the Power Corporation and therefore been central to the Canada China Business Council: Pierre Trudeau, Brian Mulroney, Paul Martin, Jean Chrétien. All of them. Have been. I mean, that's elite capture on a grand scale for Beijing.
So, but when you say elite capture, do you believe that they had Canada's best interest at heart, China's best interests? Were they being influenced directly or indirectly?
No, I think they were. I mean, if we're talking about those four prime ministers, they all believed or were led to believe that China and business with China, relations with China, was a huge opportunity for Canada. But that's just not true. I mean, if you look at the figures that come out of Ottawa and come out of various Canadian institutions these days, they tell a false story about the relationship with China and the potential of that relationship. We can come back in a moment to what the Huawei affair showed, but let's just take some of those figures. You know, we are told, for example, that China is our second largest trading partner after the United States, and that gets repeated. It is not true. The European Union is our second largest trading partner, and by a long chalk, we sell three to four times more to the European Union than we sell to China. We sell around 5% of our exports go to China every year, 5 to 7. It varies a bit. A couple of years ago, The Economist magazine, which has a very good research arm called the Intelligence Unit, they did a global ranking of countries based on the importance to their economies of their exports to China. Canada is 47th on the list. We could lose the Chinese market for our exports tomorrow, and we'd be over it by the end of next week, quite honestly. It's another example of how the figures get.
So what you're saying is we import a lot of things from China.
We import a lot, and a lot of it goes straight into the landfill because a lot of it is total junk. Yeah. But in terms of our exports, here's another example. This is an important one. You'll remember after the Huawei affair got going, apart from kidnapping the two Michaels, China imposed what in fact were economic sanctions on Canada and stopped importing grains and meats, including pork. Now, some Canadian producers went squirrely because they said, oh, China is the largest market for Canadian pork, largest export market for Canadian pork. Well, that is both true and not true. It is true that in terms of weight, we send more pork to China than any other export market. And it's worth quite a bit. It's worth $500 million a year. But in terms of value, it is a fraction only of what we sell to Japan. We sell 2.5 times.
I was going to say the best bacon in Canada, I'm told, it can be found in Japan.
Yeah, we sell 2.5 times as much in value to Japan as we do to China. 1.2, 1.3 billion worth of pork. But that's the way figures get distorted. I mean, I try to avoid using, and in the book I've tried always to try and avoid using figures from Canadian sources on China because they can't be trusted. Most of the figures I use are World Bank or OECD, Organization for Economic and Cooperation and Development numbers, because they're far more trustworthy. The notion that we have this special relationship with China has been inculcated into the whole of our official business and academic life, and it's utter nonsense. It's utter nonsense.
So you said at the beginning that part of why Paul Lynn wanted to come here was kind of a foothold into North America to get at the Americans, not necessarily the American market, although we saw that during it was one of our trade disputes with the Trump administration. I had to agree with the Trump administration. They were angry over Chinese steel being dumped into the American market because they would send it to Canada. We'd polish it once with a little cloth, ship it down to them, claim it was Canadian. And they said, well, wait a minute. They warned us for, I think, 18 months, you have to stop this. We didn't. And then they put tariffs on all of our steel. The Chinese use Canada to get at America, both in terms of trade and influence, don't they?
Yeah. At that time, Paul Lynn became known to the Americans as a very dependable mailbox if you wanted to send letters to Beijing. And if you wanted to get replies, he was living in Montreal, obviously as a professor at McGill. But he had in his house, and I found this in an FBI secret report on him. He had in his house a telephone which was linked to the switchboard in the Chinese embassy in Ottawa. So he was, he was that closely linked to everything. And I found a lot of documents from American businessmen who were trying to get into China ahead of diplomatic relations being established. And Paul Lynn was the route they took.
So that was then. That was 1969, 70, 71. What about now? Is that still their goal? And why are they interested in... I know why they're interested in our business. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But why would they be interested in choosing our government? Why would they be interested in making sure that in the last two elections that Justin Trudeau stay in power?
Well, I'm not sure that they did that. I think that's been a bit exaggerated. I think what they're interested in is being able to influence government, and that's slightly different. And that they have. I mean, you know, there's still a huge, despite the Huawei affair and despite the kidnapping of the two Michaels and all the horrors that were entailed in that, there are still a lot of officials and politicians in all levels of Canadian government who say, oh, well, you know, we have to keep contact, we have to maintain relations, so on and so forth. And I'm not sure that we do. I mean, I think the lesson of the Huawei affair, that you cannot have a reasonable, rational relationship with a regime whose first instinct when there's a problem is to take hostages. I mean, that just speaks of a cultural gulf which is unbridgeable for us.
Well, I would agree with you on that. However, the current government sees things differently. And our foreign minister, Melanie Joly, has just dispatched her deputy minister, David Morrison, who is one of these people who apparently fails upwards, as they often do in Ottawa. He was the national security and intelligence advisor for a hot second during all of this, wrote a report that detailed some problems with Chinese election interference, which the prime minister says he didn't read. He missed some of the things that were happening. We know all of this due to the inquiry, and yet he's the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs and has now been sent over by Joly. She sends him on a mission to patch things over with China. Does that make any sense to you, Jonathan?
No. I think that for the foreseeable future, we should have a simple transactional relationship. And you want to buy our wheat? Fine. Send us a check. We'll send you the wheat. As simple as that. Let's not forget, all the other stuff in the background. The repression in Hong Kong. Now, Hong Kong is a Canadian city, for heaven's sake. Well, the Canadians are the largest minority in Hong Kong. And yet, okay, we made a bit of a noise about it when this new national security law was imposed, and they started locking up all the pro-reform, pro-political reform activists, but basically we've done nothing. And equally, this is something else that gets my goat. We now have very clear UN reports, and this is unusual for the UN because the China has a huge influence there. We have UN reports saying that China uses slave labor in Xinjiang, in its production facilities. Now, we quite rightly get very upset about the slavery in Canada and in North America, over the previous 200 years. And yet we're happily buying junk from China today made by slave labor. I mean, I find this incomprehensible.
And a major consulting firm that may have connections to the government, once headed by a Canadian, held a conference right near one of those camps. Jonathan, we've got to take a break, but when we come back, I want to talk about the business capture and how that relates to the influence on politicians, because I've got an example from a few years ago that I want to bring up, and I think it still holds true today. Why is there no political will? I think because of the business capture. We'll talk about that when we come back.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Back in 2006, when Stephen Harper was first elected, the new Conservative Prime Minister took a very strong stand on China, particularly when it came to Hussein Salil, a Chinese Uyghur who was imprisoned. I'm not sure that we could find anyone today at Global Affairs Canada, as it's now called, who would have anything to say about Hussein Salil. He is a forgotten man 18 years after the fact. And the reason I bring this up is the idea of business capture influencing the political response to China. So Harper took a very strong stand, and there was a famous story. He was at an international conference, and he had gone to use the restroom. Chinese leader did. He waited outside the restroom to talk to the Chinese leader and say, "We want our citizen back." The response from the Canadian media, and especially driven by the business media and the business culture in this country, was, how dare he do that to a Chinese leader? And why are we putting our business relations at risk for this guy we don't even know? Well, he's a Canadian citizen. You know, that should be enough. It's like, you know, claiming I am a Roman. Well, then you get the rights of citizenship. Harper kept his hard line on China for a while till he realized he's just getting beaten up every day by the business culture in this country, and it's not winning him any votes.
I've already mentioned the Power Corporation and the Canada-China Business Council. If you look at who the founding companies were in the Canada-China Business Council, it's the elite of Canadian business. It's all the banks, the insurance companies, the investment companies, and major manufacturing companies who moved their manufacturing to China. Now, all those big boys, they got sweetheart deals from the Chinese Communist Party early on, and that has stayed. Those links have stayed. And these, of course, are the companies that can get ministers on the phone. They are the companies that arrange donations to political parties, and all this sort of thing. They have influence, and they use that influence. If you look at what happened after the two Michaels were kidnapped, a lot of the pressure to try and resolve this and to free Meng Wanzhou came from the business community. And, guys like Jean Chrétien were going around the business community telling them to put pressure on Justin Trudeau government to release Meng Wanzhou. That's where a great deal of the influence is. You're quite right. Absolutely. And China looks after that clientele of its here very, very well. But, not for the benefit of Canadians.
Looking at the founding members on the website, and you're absolutely right. That's who it is. I'm highly critical of the Trudeau government, as most people know. But I had to give them credit, and I did consistently, for not releasing Meng Wanzhou throughout that entire ordeal. That would have sent exactly the wrong signal. And to this day, I give him credit for that. I still think that overall, I believe the Prime Minister has a soft spot for China. And I'm not just talking about his offhand comment years ago about how he admires their basic dictatorship and allows them to turn green on a dime. Although I do believe he fundamentally holds that view. But is there something... does it go beyond naivete for him? Because there's a long-standing relationship with China and his family. His father, even before he entered politics, had traveled through China back when it was very difficult for Westerners to travel through China. Do you think that the Trudeau family just has this vision that China is the future? And I don't think that's an idea that's unique to them, but do you think that there is a family connection to this, the way that the current prime minister and current government holds and views China?
I think that may well be the case. But I think if you look at why Meng Wanzhou was not released, I think it'd be nice to say, Justin Trudeau stood up for the rule of law. I don't think that's what happened at all. If you look at, and I deal with this in the new chapters, and if you look at the situation that Canada was in there, we were stuck between China and the US, and we had to decide whose team we were on. And with Trump in the White House, there was absolutely no doubt whose team we had to be on. You know, in terms, I mean, I've already talked a bit about our trade relationship. Yeah, the US is by far our most important relationship from any perspective, and not least of trade. And Trump had already shown that he was prepared to pay hardball on the trade side. We had absolutely no choice from a very crude point of view of self-interest, but to do it the way Washington wanted it played on that thing. And it, you know, it meant putting Canadians at risk, sure. But we had no choice on it. I wish I could say that, you know, we stood up for the rule of law. I don't think we did. We stood up for self-interest in the end.
I would like to say that I wish our foreign policy was always decided by self-interest in what's right for Canada. Unfortunately, I don't think that's the case anymore. It's what will get us the votes within the various diaspora communities. That seems to be the driving force.
It's been like that for a long time.
It appears to be getting worse. It's long been the case. So is China part of the future, though? Do these business elites, the politicians that do this, maybe we should downplay the politicians because, you know, once they retire, they all run off and get a job as a lobbyist for China, and that's cross party lines. But in terms of the business council that you're talking about and the business elites, and they view China as the future, you seem skeptical of that.
I think they're turning away from that. I mean, I've seen some internal papers and talked to people in the Power Corporation, which, as I've said, is the moving force behind the Canada-China Business Council. And they, a few years ago, began to turn away from China quite significantly and turn towards Europe. They see Europe as the future now. And I think they're right. China has some really serious internal structural economic problems, not least of which is that the Chinese Communist Party will not countenance any kind of political reform. In fact, it is now by far the most technologically sophisticated totalitarian state the world has ever seen. I mean, it is quite extraordinary.
And they've gone backwards.
Absolutely, absolutely backwards under Xi Jinping. And so I don't think, and we're also, of course, you know, we're getting now a real security head-to-head in the Pacific Ocean. The Americans are now butting chests with Beijing. Beijing has shown that it is keen on imperial expansion. It seems intent on trying to take Taiwan one way or another. It is Belt and Road Initiative has given it outposts all over the Indian Ocean and Africa. It definitely
has. And our money is helping invest in that through the Asian Infrastructure Bank.
Well, sure, we should have pulled out of that. We should have pulled our money out of that. And I hope we will do so. We should never have got involved in it to begin with. I mean, it was quite clearly a propaganda operation to start with, and the accounting rules and regulations were abysmal. I mean, it was clearly a briber's bank. It was designed entirely to capture elite in Africa and Asia, and that's what it's proved. No, we should never have got involved in that to begin with.
Before we get into the academic side and why we need to be worried about that, China is also politically aligning with Russia, with Iran. This is the new axis of evil, if you will, that is sowing chaos around the world.
Yep, absolutely. I don't understand why the self-delusion slides in Ottawa and in other places amongst politicians and officials that somehow there is a a residual friendship between our regimes, between our government. The Chinese Communist Party saw us as useful idiots, and they've milked it for all it's worth.
But, you know, just an interesting aside on the how effective they can be at changing people's views or changing language, changing narrative. The current iteration of the Conservative Party. So under Erin O'Toole, they took a hard line. They believe they lost votes and seats over that. Erin O'Toole testified at the inquiry. He believes they lost 9 seats. The current Conservative leader doesn't talk about China. He talks about Beijing. And he's constantly trying to make that differentiation that it's the government. And I don't think it's because he's trying to be politically correct. He doesn't want to lose the votes in the next election. He doesn't want to give Beijing any reason to tell the Chinese diaspora community through their very Beijing-controlled social Chinese language social media, this guy's out to get you. They'll do it anyway. But it is interesting how it changes the language. So I wonder how it changes the research, the language, what is produced in our academic institutions when Beijing is so heavy. You know, there's a lot of talk since October 7th and the attack on Israel by Hamas and the fact that they were funded by Qatar about how much money has gone into American institutions from Qatar. That buys influence. That buys changes. Here we've had China for years doing this. There were attempts to at least get Huawei out of some of this because there was a feeling that Huawei was just stealing intellectual property. How big of an issue was this, and has it been curtailed at all?
Not so far as I've seen. This started at the very beginning after diplomatic relations were established in 1970, and we started having student exchanges. And I, in the first edition of the book, I mean, I've got a lot of figures on that. When China started sending students over here, they all went and did technical subjects. And Canada applauded this because they thought it would be a nice, you know, part of China's remodeling, re-establishment of its economy and the construction of its economy. You know, the Canadians who went to China were all Maoists who went to study the, you know, the Cultural Revolution and so on and so on, and continue to be, you know. And I mean, they were known as Paul Lin's Maoists. Yeah, they were many. So. And that has continued, and the infiltration of Canadian universities by the Chinese Communist Party has become more and more sophisticated over the years, to the extent, of course, that they actually have spy operations in most of the universities where there are Chinese students. What has happened most recently is that with the modernization of the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese military, they have been off stealing military technology wherever they can find it. And Canada is one of the major destinations that the People's Liberation Army scientists come to either steal or develop with Canadian help military technology.
Our biolab in Winnipeg.
Yeah. Well, there's that as well. That's part of it.
I'm sure that's part of the updated book.
Yeah. It's in there. But you know, one of the big universities that targeted by the People's Liberation Army scientists, who, by the way, all cover their background, so it's very hard to identify them as PLA. Waterloo is one of the big ones. It ranks amongst one of the top universities in the world as a destination for People's Liberation Army scientists. But there's also McGill, the University of Toronto, Western, UBC. These are all targets for.
I am sitting right now, just steps from the University of Toronto campus. I live downtown. And the change in population when the school season starts, it's massive Chinese foreign students coming in. And it has been for the entire time I've lived here. Are most of those students, do you think, is it beyond sending people over to steal technical secrets now? I mean, there's thousands and thousands of them just here at U of T.
Well, and of course, remember, these students are no longer the largest contingent in Canadian universities. Indian students are now. But, I mean, you have to go back about 20, 30 years on this, when various levels of government shrank away from funding necessary assets at Canadian universities. And they said to the Canadian universities, just take in more foreign students, charge them three or four times what you'd charge domestic students, and use the money for all these extra halls and assets that you want to build. And of course, at the same time, Canada has quietly and without really any public discussion made foreign students an essential part of our immigration policy, because they all get the opportunity for permanent residency. Which
it's the Canadian Experience Program, yes.
I mean, I remember in South Africa around the time of the end of the apartheid, Canada advertising in the local newspapers there for South African doctors. Now, we know how successful that was. We robbed South Africa of every ruddy doctor we can get on the plains. And I think that this pillaging of the brightest and best from developing countries is quite frankly immoral. We get a good standard of educated young immigrants, but at the same time, we robbing their countries of intellectual assets which their countries need. I find it quite disgusting myself. But I'm surprised that there isn't more public discussion and public questioning of this use of the foreign students as an essential part of our immigration policy. It's bizarre.
And an essential part of keeping the universities open. Give us a quick plug for your book, Jonathan. I've got the 2019 edition, but the 2024 edition comes out, you said, when? June, is it?
The new edition comes out the first week in May. It's a Star Wars book. Star Wars book. May the 4th be with me. it's five new chapters. It shows an absolutely radical change in Canada's attitude towards China, at least amongst ordinary Canadians. The polls show that while the Canadians as a whole had a pretty benign view of the People's Republic of China up to the moment when Meng Wanzhou was detained and then the two Michaels were kidnapped, Canadian public opinion has turned dramatically against the People's Republic of China since then, and maintains that position. I mean, the politicians are they're not even running to catch up. They are so far removed from the attitude of the bulk of Canadians towards the regime in Beijing. It's quite astonishing.
So that gives me something else to ask you about, and then I promise I'll let you go. In the United States, it used to be a bipartisan consensus that China was the future. It was Bill Clinton that brought China into the World Trade Organization. George W. Bush kept relations going, wanted to expand them. And now it's a bipartisan consensus that China is a very much a problem for Western democracies, for the health of the economy. We don't have that here. We've got one party saying it's a problem, and we've got three others, four if you count the Greens, but there's only two of them, saying, oh no, China is still the future. Why are our politicians so far behind the public?
Well, I mean, we are not very good at bipartisan approaches. I mean, a huge contrast with Australia on this. Australia manages to have a bipartisan foreign policy, bipartisan defense policy. We don't. We have a situation where as soon as you get a change of government, the first thing they do is cancel all the defense contracts that were introduced by the previous government. And and there's no consensus on foreign policy. I mean, I had hoped that you know that the rigors of COVID-19 would lead to a reassessment of our national interests and our national security. But it hasn't happened. You know, we're dithering again. We are a nation of ditherers sometimes, and we just won't look the truth in the face sometimes. And it really is. I find it very annoying, and it's very dangerous because it makes us an easy victim for a single-minded government or regime like Beijing. We're just sitting there waiting to be plucked.
Jonathan, thanks so much for the time.
My pleasure.
Claws of the Panda, the update edition, comes out May the 4th. May the 4th be with you, Jonathan. Do check the book out. The original edition was fantastic in detailing what had already happened. This gives you the next 5 years, so do check it out. Full Comment is a post-media podcast. My name is Brian Lilly, your host. This episode was produced by Andre Prude. Theme music by Bryce Hall. Kevin Libben is the executive producer. You can subscribe to Full Comment on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, the new YouTube podcasts. Listen through the app or Alexa-enabled devices. Help us out by giving us a rating or leaving a review and telling your friends about us. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Brian Lilly.